even before that took effect, at the end of last year, the Selective Service did give notice that they will be turning over their existing registration list for immigration enforcement and other purposes. And once it goes to DOJ, we don't know what those other purposes are, but given the information in the database, it's particularly likely to be weaponized for other purposes against vulnerable trans and immigrant youth.
And finally, if you don't have a draft, how does it end up? It's poor people who go into the military because they need the financial support, and that's who ends up fighting U.S. wars. We have 30 seconds.
I think the important thing is to take the draft off the table, remove it from the arsenal of war planning, which by forcing the government to confront the question before they make wars of whether enough people will fight them, actually constrains wars before they happen, as opposed to fighting an anti-war movement after they're on.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. Edward Hasbrook, organizer with the Anti-Draft Coalition, will link to your new piece. Even if Team Trump wanted it, a military draft would be a fiasco. That does it for our show. I'll be speaking tonight at the Independent Film Center, IFC, at West 4th and 6th Avenue. Steal the Story, Please. The film about Democracy Now! Continues at the IFC in its first week here in New York City. I'll be doing Q&A with the director, Carl Diehl, and tomorrow as well at 1:30, then headed to the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington, New York, for the screening of the film there. Check our website, democracynow.org. Then we head to Los Angeles, the Lemley Theaters, and the Roxy in San Francisco and beyond. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Hi.
Hello?
Is this Jerry Ramone?
Yes, it is.
Why do you still sound the same after all these years?
Because it's me.
No, but I mean the band.
Because we're great.
Because you're great.
Hey, oh, let's go. Hey, oh, let's go. Hey.
Tune in Wednesday, April 15th at 8 p.m. as we celebrate Joey Ramone Day. Grab a slice or some chicken vindaloo and tune in to Ditch Digger as we remember Joey Ramone. That's Joey Ramone Day at 8 p.m. April 15th right here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from the Clinton Street Theater, a movie theater and community space in Southeast Portland, presenting independent films, live music, theater productions, and more. Information about current screenings is available at cstpdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Governor Kotek indicates she may veto a bill changing public meeting law.
Environmental groups in Portland deliver a letter to the mayor rejecting the city's investigation into Zenith Energy.
And in national news, an uptick in those applying to be a conscientious objector in the U.S. military.
Good
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 13th, 2026. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Althea Billings. Oregon Governor Tina Kotek signals she may veto a bill that would change Oregon's public meeting law. House Bill 4177 passed with overwhelming support during the short legislative session earlier this year, but even the sponsors say it has its flaws. The bill was intended to make it less confusing for lawmakers to follow public meeting law by adding certain exemptions to their communication. As it's written, the bill states that serial communications between a quorum of decision makers for information gathering is exempt from needing to be disclosed to the public. That's a pretty big change, and one that journalists, good government groups, and the Ethics Commission worried would undermine transparency. Governor Kotek must decide by Friday if she will veto this bill. A two-thirds vote from the State House and Senate can override the governor's veto. It's the only bill from the short session this year that Kotek has indicated she may reject.
Eight local environmental groups delivered a letter to the mayor's office today saying they reject the process and results of an investigation into Zenith Energy earlier this year. In March 2025, the Portland City Council passed a resolution that directed Mayor Wilson to investigate whether or not Zenith had violated its franchise agreement. The city report was released this February and determined that Zenith was in compliance. Environmental groups feel that the investigation was too narrow in scope, was tainted by conflicts of interest, omitted relevant information, and did not fully utilize the city's investigative authority. Deneen Crow is a campaign director for 350 PDX, a local environmental organization. She said, quote, "We all, as a climate community, feel pretty frustrated right now with the mayor, and there were things that he said on record during his campaign trail related to climate that have not happened, or they're the opposite," end quote. Houston-based Zenith was fined $370,000 by the Oregon DEQ in 2024 for illegally constructing and using new piping to transport fossil fuels over a three-year period. The company specializes in bulk liquid storage containers and has North American terminals in Oregon, Southern California, Illinois, and Mississippi.
Oregon State Police and Clackamas County deputies shot and killed a suspected drunk driver on Sunday night. State troopers stopped the driver on Highway 26 around 7 p.m., and after the trooper came to talk to the driver, they fled. The vehicle was then stopped about 2.5 miles down the road near Barlow Trail Roadhouse in Welches. In a statement, Oregon State Police said, quote, "The traffic stop culminated in a deadly use of force. A single suspect was struck by gunfire and declared deceased at the scene," end quote. The killing is now being investigated by the Clackamas County Major Crimes Team. The identity of the deceased is unknown.
If your nose is stuffier than usual this spring, you are not alone. Oregon's pollen season is getting longer and more intense as the climate warms, and experts have some tips to help keep pollen out of your home while lowering your energy bills. Isabel Charlet has more on that story.
This pollen season is shaping up to be the longest on record in Oregon, and experts say there are many free or low-cost things people can do around their home to keep their indoor air clean that will also save money on energy bills. Warmer temperatures mean more plants are creating pollen at the same time, and the state's pollen season is about a month longer than in the 1970s. Jamie Seymour with Energy Trust of Oregon says just like in wildfire season, when there is a high pollen count, filters on HVAC systems can get dirtier faster.
That means your system has to work even harder to get that same amount of air pushed through, and that uses more energy. So check your filter maybe about every 2 to 3 weeks rather than every few months, and replace it if it looks dirty.
She adds people should make sure to check the guidelines for their systems to make sure they are using the right kind of filter, as that can also be an expensive energy drain. Seymour says anywhere air can get into a home, pollen can too. She recommends using weather stripping to seal up any gaps and cracks around doors, windows, and vents. She adds it's a good idea to keep windows closed when the pollen is high and recommends people switch thermostats to the fan-only setting.
That means the air distribution and filtration keeps that clean air inside, and it uses less energy than, say, a full system cycle.
Portable air filters can travel from room to room and help keep air breathable, especially if they have a HEPA filter. Seymour says Energy Trust offers a $75 discount on some Energy Star high-efficiency air purifiers. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
New Hampshire voting rights advocates decry a ban on student IDs at the polls as Congress continues to debate the Save America Act. The far-right leader is defeated in Hungary, and Virginians with felony convictions may have their voting rights restored if an amendment passes. With those stories and more, it's Simone Perez with 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2026 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The Trump administration has openly stated a desire to ensure that only, quote, the right people are voting. And laws like this one are how that goal is pursued at the state level.
Lisa Kovac of the New Hampshire Campaign for Voting Rights slams a state ban on using student IDs at the polls. Under the new state law, the eighth in the country, college students will have to show a separate government-issued photo ID, despite needing a passport or driver's license to get student identification. GOP lawmakers argued students could use fake IDs. Opponents said there is no proof that ever happens, and call the law a bid to suppress rising youth turnout ahead of the midterms. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban and his far-right populist party were routed in an election yesterday, despite President Donald Trump promising to tilt trade and economic policy towards him. In more than a decade and a half in power, the anti-EU, pro-Putin Orban extensively changed Hungary's politics and electoral system to fortify his power. Voters objected to current corruption, in spite of a last-minute campaign rally with Vice President J.D. Vance, who called Orban a defender of Western civilization.
Understand that Western civilization, so despised by the left, it's not something that's self-sustaining. We can't sit on our hands and expect that everything is going to be fine. Our civilization, we've got to work at it.
Voting rights activists say they're watching as Congress resumes debate on the Save America Act, a major Trump priority. The strict national voter ID bill has already passed the House with support from four Democrats, but Senate Democrats have so far successfully stalled it there. Joyce Le Bombard with the Texas League of Women Voters says it'll disenfranchise married women who took their husband's last name.
Their ID, their passport, their voter ID will not match their birth certificate. So all of those women now have to jump through that extra hoop.
Trump allies argue it's needed to stop non-citizen voting. Opponents point out that almost never happens. They point out it makes registration drives harder and voter roll purges more common, denying the ballot more often to rural and disengaged voters and those without stable housing. Kansas Republican lawmakers just overrode Democratic Governor Laura Kelly's veto of legislation that mirrors the federal bill. Virginia is the only state requiring a person with a felony record to individually petition the governor to restore their voting rights. That might change in November when voters decide on a constitutional amendment that would automatically restore those voting rights once people are released from prison. Nicole Porter with the Sentencing Project calls the ballot a fundamental democratic right for folks who want to take part in civic life.
These are individuals that don't lose their right to citizenship, and them being able to vote and participate in democracy, making choices about who governs them, is important.
4 million people with felony convictions were barred from voting in the last presidential election. I'm Simone Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after the newscast for an in-depth interview with climate attorney Nick Caleb about environmental advocates' response to Portland's investigation of the embattled oil-by-rail company Zenith Energy. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. And then at 7, stick around for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 47 degrees. Tomorrow, expect rain conditions with a high of about 52. Today in history, in 1976, the U.S. Treasury reintroduces the $2 bill in honor of the 233rd anniversary of Thomas Jefferson's birthday in the United States Bicentennial Celebration. Quote of the day is from Jefferson, who said, quote, "I would rather be exposed to the inconveniences attending too much liberty than to those attending too small a degree of it." ¶¶
Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy stopped by the Tribal Self-Governance Conference in Phoenix, Arizona, touting the Trump administration's tribal health accomplishments so far. With that story and more, it's Jill Freitas with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas. Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. made a stop in the Phoenix Metro to visit the Gila River Indian community last week. As KJZZ's Gabriel Piatarasio reports, Kennedy touted tribal health accomplishments a year into President Trump's second term.
Kennedy briefly took the stage at Wild Horse Pass during the annual Tribal Self-Governance Conference.
We're going to make Indian country healthy again. Thank you all very, very much.
In his speech, Kennedy talked about making progress on key issues like food sovereignty, chronic disease, and federal dietary guidelines. He, along with the USDA, literally flipped the food pyramid upside down, tackling staffing shortages and aging infrastructure across the entire Indian Health Service was another topic. Yet the now-defunct DOGE terminated a dozen leases for IHS facilities. This decision was seen as a cost-savings measure to shore up funds tied into federal office space. And according to data from Stanford's Big Local News, the U.S. also canceled 121 IHS contracts totaling over $8 million last year. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
The federal government is encouraging tribes to partner with data centers. That could mean leasing land or, as the Mountain West News Bureau's Hannah Merzbach reports, selling power.
At a U.S. Department of Energy webinar, Ken Aumann with Colusa Indian Energy said that's where the big bucks come in.
Potentially billions of dollars into the coffers of tribes.
His company provides energy infrastructure to data centers on tribal land. He says these partnerships can be good for tribes that have land and resources to power big projects, like the Osage Nation in Oklahoma. Paul Beemore is the chair of the tribe's utility board.
Tribes that are casino dependent really need to look at other ways to build their economies. And I think that data centers is one of those opportunities.
Though Beemore says people may be wary about how this will impact the environment. Other tribes have expressed concerns about data centers draining precious water supplies. For National Native News, I'm Hannah Merzbach.
The Native Youth Olympics begin this week in Anchorage. The games kick off Thursday, April 16th at the Alaska Airlines Center, bringing together hundreds of student athletes from across the state. Now in its 54th year, the Native Youth Olympics celebrate traditional Alaska Native games rooted in survival skills, strength, and endurance. Events include the one-foot high kick, seal hop, and wrist carry, all designed to test both physical ability and mental toughness. Ann Lawrence is from Point Hope and a cultural advisor for the Cook Inlet Tribal Council. She says watching the children reunite every year brings her joy.
My favorite thing is I love watching the kids participate. You see the friendship that has grown over the years. And, you know, some of the ones that have started out as freshmen are graduating from high school. And they're very involved. And it just warms my heart that these kids know that what they are doing here is something that they can share with their future relatives, maybe as they become parents, grandparents. I think it's so important.
The games run Thursday through Saturday and are free and open to the public. I'm Jill Freitas.
Missouri health officials are warning about nitazenes, a powerful synthetic opioid now appearing in the state's drug supply. Experts say the drugs are stronger than fentanyl and often mixed into other substances, increasing overdose risk. Narcan can still reverse overdoses through multiple doses may be needed. Crystal Blair has more.
Missouri health officials are raising concerns about a powerful new drug showing up in the state's illegal opioid supply as overdose deaths remain a major issue. Close to 2,000 Missourians have died from drug overdoses in recent years. Experts say a class of synthetic opioids known as nitazenes is now being detected, and they say they're far more potent than fentanyl. Derek Wilson, overdose prevention coordinator with APO Community Health Center in Springfield, says the strength is what makes them so dangerous.
It's stronger than fentanyl, and we're talking, you know,
5 to 9 times, up to 10 times more potent and strong than fentanyl. And we're talking potentially hundreds of times stronger than morphine.
As nitazene spread across Missouri, health experts say a critical tool for preventing overdose deaths remains widely available. Naloxone, also known as Narcan, can still reverse overdoses, but Wilson notes stronger drugs may require multiple doses of the antidote. With nitazenes now showing up in Missouri's drug supply, health experts say prevention and awareness are critical, especially since users may not know what they're taking, and Wilson says there's no commercially available wide-scale test to detect nitazenes.
We're coming at a new thing that's laced in with old substances that make those that much more potent and that much more lethal. We are just all hands on deck trying to scramble and make sure folks have enough Narcan or some type of naloxone.
He recommends never using alone, starting with small amounts and making sure someone nearby can respond in case of an overdose.
Be aware that whatever you're about to take in may have more punch to it than you expect.
For Missouri News Service, I'm Crystal Blair.
More service members in the U.S. military are seeking to end their service, NPR reports. The uptick started after the start of the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran, particularly after the U.S. bombed a girls' school in Iran, which killed 165 people. The Center on Conscience and War operates a 24-hour GI rights hotline. They say they took on 80 clients last month, almost twice as many as in an average year. It's a small amount compared to the over 1 million people enlisted, but former military officials and observers told NPR it spells trouble for the military's ability to retain troops. Becoming a conscientious objector is a drawn-out process, but it's one way service members can be removed from duties they object to right away. Thousands of Americans use the status to avoid being drafted in the Vietnam War, but without a draft, those applying to become conscientious objectors voluntarily signed up for military service. Steve Wolford helps run the GI Rights Hotline. Wolford told NPR, quote, "We've had a lot of calls from people who don't identify as nonviolent or pacifists. They identify as everyday service members who are willing to defend the country but feel very unsettled and suspicious about the ways the military is being used now," end quote. Experts say hard data on service members trying to leave the military won't show up for years. For their part, the Pentagon pushed back on the idea that retention could be a problem for the military. A spokesperson said via email, quote, "There are zero retention concerns for fiscal year 2026. Every service is meeting its targets, and any suggestion otherwise is completely false."
2025 saw the highest level of global deadly violence against Jewish people in over three decades. At least 20 people were killed in anti-Semitic attacks, according to a study by Tel Aviv University. The report tracks incidents that range from physical attacks and vandalism to verbal threats and harassment on social media. The violence, which included a fatal attack at a Hanukkah celebration in Australia, continued a spike that began following the Hamas terrorist-led attack on Israel in October 7, 2023. It is likely Israel's subsequent war on Gaza worsened the anti-Semitics. The report's authors said, quote, "The data raises concern that a high level of anti-Semitic incidents is becoming a normalized reality," end quote. Anti-Semitic attacks with fatalities were recorded on three continents. 15 people were killed at Sydney's Bondi Beach in December. There were additional deaths in two anti-Semitic attacks in the U.S., in Washington, D.C., and Colorado. And in Great Britain, two people were killed at a Manchester synagogue on Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the Jewish calendar. The report found that 2025 was the deadliest year for anti-Semitic attacks since 1994, when the bombing of a Jewish community center in Argentina killed 85 people and wounded more than 300. Iran and the terrorist group Hezbollah have been blamed for that event, according to the report. There was a moderate increase in the overall number of anti-Semitic incidents last year compared with 2024, but that total represents a huge jump from 2022 before the Israel-Gaza war. Most physical attacks were carried out by people acting on their own, which is why it is so difficult to try to prevent them, experts say.
As colon cancer cases rise among young adults, a new treatment for certain late-stage cases has proved promising. One medical oncologist explains the clinical trial focuses on training the immune system to fight the cancer rather than using chemotherapy. Simone Perez reports.
As colon cancer rates among people under 50 skyrocket, a new clinical trial that uses immunotherapy rather than physically demanding chemotherapy is yielding promising results. Spencer Laird received an initial colon cancer diagnosis and surgery, but his cancer returned and 13 tumors were found on his lungs. Laird feared the side effects of chemotherapy, but his wife, Carly Ann, researched alternative treatments. They landed on a clinical trial at Duke University that tests the combination of immunotherapy drugs. A traditional treatment like chemotherapy targets rapidly dividing cells in the body, a hallmark of cancer. The problem is many healthy cells divide rapidly too, which contributes to chemotherapy side effects like nausea, fatigue, and hair loss. Immunotherapy helps train healthy cells to seek and destroy only cancerous cells.
I think that if I were even still here, I would more than likely be in pretty bad shape, just the side effects and the sickness and everything that comes along with the chemo and radiation. I just feel very blessed to not have had to do that, to have kind of another way out. Not only another way out that don't have side effects, but that is working.
The couple now makes the 8-hour drive from their home to Durham every 2 weeks for treatment. For Laird, the results for his particular type of cancer have been encouraging. He now has just 3 tumors, the biggest of which is the size of a pencil eraser. Dr. Nicholas DeVito is a medical oncologist and assistant professor at Duke University. He says immunotherapy can give patients with certain late-stage intestinal cancers a better chance at living longer, and without the side effects and limited success that sometimes accompany chemotherapy.
With immunotherapy, you're retraining your immune system. It is learning to fight the cancer off inside your body. This really treats cancer more of like an immune failure rather than like an infection that you're treating with like an antibiotic like chemotherapy.
Colorectal cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death in the U.S. I'm Simone Perez, North Carolina News Service.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 13th, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Chris Gao, Josh Salem, and Dave Johnson. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineers are Nick Caperso and Mike Vitaklis. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Simone Perez, Crystal Blair, and Jill Freitas. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Dave Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programs, you can do that at kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. On Monday morning, a coalition of environmental groups delivered a letter to Portland Mayor Keith Wilson rejecting the city's investigation into the embattled oil-by-rail company Zenith Energy. The investigation into Zenith's dealings with the city was years in the making. One of the first major policy wins for the new city council was passing a resolution calling on the mayor to investigate Zenith and their dealings with city staff. Zenith Energy has a franchise agreement with Portland, which allows it to operate and use things like the public right-of-way. If they were found to violate their franchise agreement, the city could take action against them. In February, the results of the investigation found no wrongdoing by Zenith or by the city. The letter environmental groups delivered today rejects those conclusions. I spoke with one of the signatories, Nick Caleb, climate and energy attorney with Breach Collective, to learn more. Tell me about this letter that was delivered by you and advocates earlier today.
On February 19th, the city released the findings of an investigation that city council asked it to do, like March of 2025. There'd been some controversy in the meantime because the initial investigation design included a lot of conflicts of interest for city officials who had been involved in some of the like backroom dealings with Zenith, were given the responsibility of doing the investigation. And so advocates, including Breach and others, and then also councilors Green and Murillo, you know, put the mayor on notice that that was bad and that we shouldn't have poorly designed investigations with conflicts of interest, because that's unlikely to lead to accountability. And so in the fall, the mayor announced that they were going to hire independent investigators. And so I think a lot of people were like, okay, that's a good sign that we're going to have some kind of like, you know, decent investigation here. But it turns out the investigation wasn't very good. The conflicts of interest were never solved. The same city staff were allowed to conduct the initial investigation, which resulted in a really narrow scope. It resulted in ignoring a bunch of really important acts that Zenith had done, and had really bad conclusions. And so, and the outside council that was supposed to support it really didn't have a very large role. They were sort of just reviewing the staff's investigation. So we were mad about that, and it took a long time to read through all their documentation, but we put this letter together. Breach and several other organizations, Portland Harbor Community Coalition, 350PDX, Greater River Campaign, many others, sent this letter rejecting the investigation, both in terms of the who did it and its conclusions, and chastising the mayor for his poor behavior.
Can we talk a little bit more specifically about what those issues were that you and the coalition found with this investigation? Can you speak more specifically to these aspects of, you know, the conflict